2020 meeting. This is session two on bioremediation advances, new strategies, optimization, and performance monitoring. I would now like to turn it over to Mark Rothas from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to provide an introduction to the series. Mark?
Thank you, Jean, and welcome everybody. Did want to point out this is session two. This session will focus on inorganics. We had our session one webinar last week, and for those of you that did miss it, it will be available soon in the archives section of the CLUIN website, where it will be where it was recorded, and the presentation materials, slides, etc. will be available as well shortly. The first session was on organics and involved three presenters. I was the first one, and my topic focused on an overview of current advances for in-situ bioremediation that included newer amendments and challenges such as DCE and vinyl chloride stall and amendment delivery techniques. The second speaker was Tony Danko of the Navy, and he presented case studies on the use of microbial assay tools, electrokinetics, to enhance amendment delivery and low permeability lithology, and an ESTCP project on the MNA and co-metabolic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane. The third speaker was Michelle Laura of USGS, and she presented case studies on the use of bioaugmentation and microbial tools for chlorobenzene anaerobic biodegradation at a bedrock site, as well as an ESTCP project involving biodegradation and use of microbial tools to evaluate DCE and DCE stall for a bedrock site, and another case study, or not a case study, but a lab work that they had been involved with in the biodegradation of PFAS, which is a current kind of high visibility topic. And again, that webinar audio and presentation materials will be available in the CLUIN archives part of their website shortly. And do you have more to go over, Jean, or are we ready to introduce speakers?
No, please go ahead and move on.
Okay. Just a brief introduction on FRTR. The Federal Technologies Roundtable works to build a collaborative atmosphere among federal agencies involved in hazardous waste site cleanups. FRTR was established in 1990 to bring together federal cleanup program subject matter experts for technology sharing and other technology-related activities of mutual interest. FRTR member agencies include the Departments of Defense, Energy, and Interior, the Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, the National Institute of Environmental Health Services Superfund Research Program, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Okay, we have four speakers for you today. I'll introduce each one before their respective presentation topics. Our first speaker is going to be Heather Henry. Heather is a program administrator for the NIEHS's Superfund Research Program at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The responsibilities include administration of the SRP's multi-project center grants, individual research project grants, and the Small Business Technology Transfer grants. She earned a BS in Biological Sciences at the University of Rochester, a PhD at the University of Cincinnati, and completed a Fulbright Fellowship at the Universities of Melbourne and Adelaide in Australia. And with that, I will turn things over to Heather.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you very much to the FRTR committee for this opportunity to talk about the SRP research in bioremediation. And I thought I'd start out with a little overview about the Superfund Research Program. Again, as Mark mentioned, we are part of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which is a part of the NIH, National Institute of Health. And the Superfund Research Program essentially began as part of the SARA legislation of 1986. Within the SARA legislation, with the establishment of a basic research program to study four mandate areas: health effects, susceptibility, and tools for remediation and detection of hazardous substances in the environment. So, coming from a basic research program, I think it's really important to, you know, as I'm going to highlight research that's in the early stages, I definitely wanted to give you an indication of a historical perspective of the bioremediation research that the SRP has supported, because we've had several success stories from the very early beginnings that are now leading to both field and, in some cases, pilot applications today. TCE work at University of Washington and UC Berkeley helped lay down some of the groundwork about TCE bioremediation. Those of you out there may remember there was a time when it was thought this was not even possible. And indeed, researchers looked into plant-based bioremediation as well as bacterial-based bioremediation, and now those are widely applied in the field. University of Iowa, the work of Jerry Schnorr has made lots of progress in PCB biodegradation, and in fact, the work of his is being applied in field sites, particularly looking at poplar trees as well as the microbes that live with them. And UC Davis and Microbi Biotech have also pioneered different types of bacterial systems that can be used to purify and clean up pollutants from drinking water, kind of in a bioreactor setup. So again, lots of innovation from the early days has seen fruit and application in today's remedial options. And again, I'm going to be talking about the early stage research that's happening now within the Superfund research program. And we do have hundreds of grant projects, and about 25 of those projects involve bioremediation. So that's what I'll be highlighting today. Those projects come from our multi-project center grants, our biogeochemical interaction grants, as well as small business grants. And at the end of my webinar, there's a link to our webpage, and if you want to learn more about those funding opportunities and others, I encourage you to check that out. Now, 25 projects, that's a lot to cover in a short period of time. Well, it turns out a lot of our bioremediation research has been featured already on CLUIN. So I'm going to note on the slides for each of the projects for which we have an archive available, and encourage you to check out those slides, to check out those archives if you're really interested in the work that I'm going to talk about. So with that, I thought I'd start out with a fairly new grantee, Jose Serrato at the University of New Mexico. And he's looking at the immobilization of uranium, arsenic, and other co-occurring metals with a particular focus in mine waste. And the work that he's doing involves rhizosphere as well as plant interactions controlling metal uptake. And I've listed a recent publication where he's looking at calcium and carbonate water and how that impacts uranium transport into the root of plants. Next, I wanted to revisit the work at University of Iowa. Again, as mentioned, they've done a lot of the groundwork in PCB degradation, both in poplar systems as well as bacterial systems. What they're working on now in particular is black carbon in biofilms and how that can be used to mitigate the bioremediation of PCBs. Okay. Great. He's also been working on pumpkin seedlings for the degradation of bisphenol A in the environment. And I should say that Jerry Schnorr is now working with Tim Mattis, also at University of Iowa. Webinar archives that we have available is for Raina Mayer's work at the University of Arizona. And in fact, the whole center at University of Arizona has quite a strength in bioremediation and microbiome understanding. So both the human health impacts as well as the environmental implications and opportunities for bioremediation. In particular, Marina Mayer is looking at compost-assisted phytostabilization and how that impacts the microbial community that helps keep native plant species alive in arid areas. Other research projects related to bioremediation include Paul Carini. He's working on very innovative high-throughput cultivation screening technique, which was also overviewed in the September webinar. And John Terover and Mark Rousseau are looking at fate and transport processes of metals as it relates to biogeochemical interactions. Michigan State University has been funded to look at dioxins. And the work that they've done in bioremediation of dioxins, again, was featured in our September webinar. And I encourage you to have a look at the excellent work that they're doing. They're really digging into the omics and understanding how the different forms of the genome impacts the degradation of dioxins in the environment. At the University of San Diego, Julian Schroeder has been working on metal transport in plant cells for a number of years. What he's doing now is applying machine learning techniques to powerfully screen through and identify genes that may be very important in the function, in the movement of metals and other types of materials through the plant system. And his work was featured in our October webinar last fall. Claudia Gunch and her colleagues at Duke University are working on several types of organic contaminants in the not just a bacterial system, but also fungal systems, and understanding how those systems are responding to contaminants in the environment and under what conditions are they most effective. They're looking in particular at biochar, and also have developed a very interesting precision bioremediation framework, which can be helpful to understand how to do genetic bioaugmentation to really optimize for degradation of contaminants in the environment. And they were featured in our October 3rd webinar last fall. Lisa Alvarez-Cohen, her work was mentioned in our early work slide with her TCE isotope research. She continues to do TCE work, as well as expanding into mixtures, which is, of course, a very important topic. Contaminants are not found alone in the environment, but often associated with other hazardous substances. And recent work with TCE and arsenic, as well as PFAS, fall under this category and were featured in our April webinar last year. Also under the biogeochemical interactions grantees is Frank Leffler and Ed Bauer. Frank has been working quite a bit on the cobamide structure, which is a part of, which is a very important aspect of the TCE biodegradation. And he's also discovered in recent work that nitrous oxide inhibits some of the bacterial reductive dechlorination of certain compounds. Ed Bauer's group at Johns Hopkins included several collaborators, one of whom is Michelle Laura. And Michelle presented the work that they did at Standard Chlorine of Delaware last Friday. So that one is fresh off the presses, and I encourage you to look at the slides from last week where they featured their anaerobic and aerobic biodegradation systems. And the last two of the biochemical interactions grantees I wanted to mention are Upal Ghosh and Helen Shikim. Upal is, actually the two of them are collaborating to a certain extent, but they're looking very much at the sorbent and different materials that can be used to assess bioavailability of methyl mercury, as well as understanding what conditions in the environment drive mercury methylation. And now I'm going to move on to talk about our small business grantees. Microbi Biotechnologies, as mentioned previously is somebody who's been funded also for some of their very early work in 1,4-dioxane. Now they're focusing more on TCE and biodegradation through a bioreactor system that they've developed. In addition, they're also working on machine learning technology to help understand conditions that are optimal for bioremediation. And this work was featured in our October webinar, as was the work of Microbial Insight. They are also looking at understanding and predicting where and what conditions are necessary to optimize for bioremediation, particularly thinking about when sites stall versus when sites, and this is primarily related to organic contaminants. And they're utilizing a database of information, genomic profiling, to understand what conditions might be leading towards active biodegradation versus ones where we might start to see and look out for stalling. And lastly, in terms of the small business grantees, Chet Boxley from GlycoSurf has developed a biological-based rhamnolipid surfactant, and they are using that to understand how metals can be adhered to and removed effectively from wastewater. And I just want to give honorable mention to other grantees who are looking at remediation success. So they are pairing the bioremediation process with toxicity testing, which helps us understand what the potential side or unintended influences of bioremediation, and just making sure that when we're seeing the disappearance of the parent product, that we are in fact seeing a reduction in toxicity as well. And so Mike Aiken's group, Stacy Simonich, and Tan Young are also working on aspects of that. And then given today's webinar features inorganic contaminant remediation, I did want to point out two past grantees and the work that they've done, since it's particularly applicable. Biocement is commercially available, and this is a material that can be used to develop a high-strength material that prevents leaching of metals from the environment, in particular mining-related sites. And Hema Regera from Michigan State University, looking more in a water system situation, but she's developed a system where geobacter species are used to precipitate out uranium. And so in summary, the Superfund research program does fund a wide variety of bacterial, fungal, and plant systems in bioremediation, moving certainly in the direction of microbiome and biofilms and complex interactions between microorganisms. We are focusing on inorganic as well as organic contaminants, several emerging contaminants, and then also mixtures, tackling the mixtures question. And through this work, we are applying innovative mechanisms that help us find new approaches to find key players and understand the function of those players, whether that's through omics or computational approaches or in combination with toxicity testing. And of course, this is basic work, but the hope is that this basic work will help inform and let us understand when conditions are better or optimal for bioremediation. And with that, I'd like to thank you. Thank the FRTR group for inviting the Superfund research program to talk a little bit about the research we're doing. There are several ways that you can learn more about the SRP, and feel free to send me an email, and I will sign you up for our various newsletters and such. And with that, I'll pass it back over to you, Mark.
Thank you, Heather. I should have mentioned at the outset that our first two speakers are more focused on kind of developmental technologies in bioremediation, which feeds into our next speaker, which is Andrea Leeson of CERDEP ESTCP, and she will be focusing on ongoing work within that program. Andrea has been the Deputy Director of CERTIFI STCP since 2014, and prior to that was the Program Manager for CERTIFI STCP's Environmental Restoration Program since 2001. Prior to that, she was a research leader at Patel Memorial Institute, where she conducted research on in-situ bioremediation and the design and implementation of innovative biological, chemical, and physical treatment technologies for site remediation and industrial wastewater. Andrea received her doctoral degree in environmental engineering from Johns Hopkins University. And with that, I will turn it over to Andrea.
Great. Thank you, Mark. And I wanted to say that I think it's great that I was following Heather, because I think you'll see that a lot of the work that we do in CERTIP and ESTCP really builds on a lot of the work that Heather does under her program, and we're kind of going up in scale in terms of to the more applied program. So what I'd like to do first is tell you a little bit about who we are in terms of CERTIP and ESTCP, talk a little bit about our program in kind of the big picture, some of our successes in this area, and then give you a snapshot of some of the work we're funding right now. So this is a sister program, or I should say a companion program. First we have CERTIP, which is the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program. This is your traditional science and technology program. A lot of this work is conducted at the bench scale, often in university laboratories or other federal labs, consulting firms, et cetera. We're very focused on the application of the work that's developed under CERTIP, though. And when this work matures, whether it's a specific technology or a body of knowledge, we'd like to see this move into ESTCP, which is our Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, for demonstration and validation of these technologies in the field. And so we actually will take this. Sometimes it's a group of projects that are working on particular issues. Sometimes it is also specific technologies, but we like to get them out to installations and demonstrate them in the real world setting. Now, CERTIP is a program that is jointly managed with the DOD, the EPA, and the Department of Energy. ESTCP is a DOD program. So we're funding agencies, and every year we release solicitations to get in new work, and we specify what topics we're interested in each year. CERTIP has been around since the 1990s. And in this picture, what I'm trying to do is give you an overview of just some of the work that we've done over the years. And what you'll see is along the x-axis, this is showing you the fiscal year, and it represents the year in which different topics of research were initiated. The boxes above are showing you the general topics, but there are several projects that have been funded within each of these areas. This is representing really just a fraction of what's been going on with groundwater bioremediation. Often bioremediation is a part of almost every single project we've funded in terms of groundwater remediation. It's just generally an aspect. There's some biological component. But we have had some topic areas that have focused a little more specifically on bioremediation, and I'm pointing them out here. They're highlighted in red. Overall, this is really representing hundreds of projects, and so what I'll try to do is give you a snapshot of what we've been doing over the years in this area. In terms of biotechnology itself, this is really just giving you an idea of some of the work that's been done over the years. You know, we started off, let me point out the key in the lower right-hand corner first. This is color-coded, and I apologize, some of the differences are just slight. But showing the fundamental scientific basis, some of those projects that were developed, moving into field demonstrations, and then ultimately we move into protocols and guidance. And this shows you, I think, pretty well how over the years, you know, we started off trying to understand the basic
scientific principles for bioremediation. And as we've learned more, we have moved into the field. Until today, you know, bioremediation is now standard practice at our DoD groundwater sites. If it makes sense, if it's applicable, we will look for a bioremediation technology to put into a site. Bioaugmentation has been a big component of this, and this has been something that we have worked on quite a bit, where you have a specific bacteria or consortium of bacteria that you'll add to the subsurface. We have been looking at bioaugmentation itself now for many years for chlorinated solvents. The commercial bioaugmentation cultures are now widely available. It's been applied at hundreds of sites. This book we pulled together with a lot of CERTIF research on bioaugmentation. This was published several years ago, so this is a pretty mature field in this area. And then we also, really, I think we closed the book on bioremediation of perchlorate-contaminated groundwater. We got started in this area under CERTIF early in the 2000s and quickly understood that the bacteria that can degrade perchlorate were really ubiquitous in the environment. We moved quickly into developing field technologies under ESTCP to treat perchlorate contaminated groundwater through biological means. And now this is really the primary treatment for groundwater at DoD sites that are contaminated with perchlorate. So now what I'd like to do is move on to a few projects that are more recent than this, that are working on some newer contaminations or newer issues for us. And you'll notice that, I'm sure you'll recognize some of the performers that Heather is also funding, that, you know, we're funding these folks as well. This is just one example. We have a project that's being led by Drs. Lisa Alvarez-Cohen and David Sedlak at UC Berkeley. And they're looking at situations where we have groundwater that's impacted by AFFF or aqueous film-forming foams and the PFAS associated with those foams and how that impacts our ability to treat groundwater that's also impacted by a common co-contaminant, often the chlorinated solvent. And so they're doing this combined approach where they're looking at persulfate in situ chemical oxidation to really knock out the more recalcitrant of these PFAS and combining this with bioremediation. This project was started in 2017, and we expect that to be finishing up within the next year or so on their results. But they have seen that that certainly the ISCO, as a really looking at it as a pre-treatment, seems to be somewhat effective for some of the PFAS, not all of them, but for some, and there is some promise there. Another project we've been working on is led by Dr. Mandy Michelson at the U.S. Army Arctic in Washington, and they are looking at developing these molecular biological tools to monitor chlorinated solvent bioremediation and use them to estimate the biodegradation rates. So that's a trend we've seen over the years, that as we've understood the basic processes and that as we've developed our treatment technologies, we've also at the same time have been developing better technologies to monitor those remediation processes. So they have been working out some of these technologies at the Joint Base Lewis-McChord, looking at various cell densities, and then their ability to quantify those rates with these biomarkers. We've also been looking at co-metabolic treatments quite a bit. This particular project is an ESCCP project that's led by Dr. Tony Danko at NASVAC Exwick in California. And what this is project they're looking at is these novel multiple primary substrates to treat mixed contamination of 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated solvents in groundwater. This is being done at Naval Air Station North Island, and they are looking at these injections of these MPS to treat these mixed contaminants. It's fairly early on in the process. This started in 2017, but there were some site selection issues. Treatability studies look promising, and we are still waiting to get the field results. Building on this co-metabolic work, we've been looking at co-metabolic technologies for a number of years, and Dr. Paul Hatzinger from Aptum is starting a training course this year about applying co-metabolism for treatment of traditional and emerging contaminants at DoD sites. He'll be doing this through both online, well, the plan was for online and on-site training seminars. Those on-site training seminars may not make a whole lot of sense within the short term. Definitely, though, we will be doing these online training seminars. And so I really encourage you to keep an eye out on our website. They will be being done as part of our webinar series. And I think this will be a really solid overview of what we know about using co-metabolism at these sites. And Paul Hatzinger has been involved in the development of this structure for this technology. And then what I'd like to highlight as well is a recent statement of need, or that's what our topic areas are that we release under CERTIP. And this was focused on biodegradation of PFAS that is found in the AFFF. And very specifically, we were looking for whether researchers would be able to identify, isolate microorganisms that are capable of degrading the perchloroalkyl acids, particularly PFAS, improving our understanding of these biodegradation processes that could lead to, you know, helping us develop a PFAS biological treatment alone, or probably more likely as part of a treatment train. And, you know, essentially just getting a better understanding of these biological treatment strategies. We selected a number of projects under that statement of need a few months ago, and so they're just getting started this year, with five different projects selected, and they're presented here. I regret that I did not put the website up. You can get more information about each of these projects on the CERTIP and ESTCP website. So if you go to CERTIP-ESTCP.org and search either of these investigators' names or this project number here, you'll get about a one-page description of exactly what they're doing and what the goal of the project is. Some of these projects, you'll see that they're listed as proof of concept after their title. That indicates that this is a one-year effort to test out their theory, and if it's successful, they would move on with additional work. So you can see three out of the five projects selected were considered proof of concept, and I think that's an indication of the difficulty of looking into biological treatment for these types of compounds. I'd like to end then with a summary of our symposium. We have our symposium every year. It is typically held the week after Thanksgiving in Washington, D.C. That means that this year it's December 1st through 3rd. It is an excellent overview of everything that we're funding at CERTIP and ESTCP. Every investigator that we fund attends and presents at least a poster, and then we also have a number of platform presentations. So you have hundreds of posters to view. It really gives state of the art on some of these different technologies. You can find the website for this, again, is available at CERTIP-ESTCP.org. And Mark, that concludes my call.
Okay, this is Jean. I'm going to come on the line here, and we'll pause briefly for a short Q&A period. I wanted to remind the audience, remember, you have a small window labeled Q&A in the lower right corner where you can share your thoughts and questions. And I have a few that are already in the queue. I wanted to start first with some questions that came in for Heather Henry. Heather, if you're on the line, if you could unmute and let me know if you, one of the first questions wonders if there were any activities with your bioremediation work where they were looking at radionuclides that were addressed or cleaned up by bioremediation.
I don't believe so, but that is something I can look into. I have a feeling I know okay. who asked that question.
Got it.
But you're welcome to, if you can hand me their information, then I'll be happy to follow up with them.
All right, sounds good. Thank you. And then what about a sustainability time frame when you're looking at bioremediation for inorganics?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think that our speakers are going to be touching on that. So Sue Hale and Haruka will be touching on that aspect specifically. But, you know, the goal is to manipulate the environment so that you are mineralizing the metal contaminant to the point that it is highly unlikely that it would become released or bioavailable in the environment. So I guess maybe that's the best way to talk about, like, the strategy there is to have the metal interact with a biota, whether it's a plant or microorganism or combination, so that the metal ends up in a mineral form that is no longer bioavailable. That helps us that gives us assurance that it has a long-term potential of stabilization.
Okay. The next question, I'm going to send this one over to Andrea. Andrea, one of the attendees wants to know, what are your perspectives on research directions that are closest in terms of development to full-scale field use?
I think, you know, a lot of our focus right now is on PFAS. In terms of, you know, biotechnologies for chlorinated solvents, I think we're fine-tuning that, I would say, right now. We understand a lot of the basic biological processes, and what we're really working on now are more of the techniques for distribution of amendments to make sure the local consortium get everything they need and to grow properly. So that is one thing that's on the cusp, is we have some demonstrations for better distribution of amendments for the chlorinated solvents. And then with PFAS, I really see that where we would go next is we're really looking at treatment trains, where we have maybe some more aggressive technologies, followed by technologies that have a biological component.
Okay. And I'll take one more question here, and this is related, and I think we'll direct it to both Heather and Andrea. But I'm going to start first with you, Andrea. One of the participants noted that, again, as you've talked about, these technologies seem to look really great when we're working with them in a lab or at a pilot scale, but then we try to make that translation out into the field, they're not always as effective in those field situations. And they're wondering what we could do to actually bridge this gap to get them to be as effective out in the field.
And, you know, I think a lot of that gets back to the distribution of the amendments, whatever type of amendment you need. And that is where a lot of our work is focusing right now, both under the research and also the demonstrations, is to better understand the distribution. We have seen where we've gone back to some sites where we've now had a new technology that's helping us determine where our amendment went, and it didn't go where it needed to go. If it had, it probably would have worked really well, but it, you know, we really didn't understand the subsurface well enough, and we didn't understand how to get the amendment distributed properly. So I think that's really where we're working hardest on right now, to make sure that the technologies that are working great at the bench scale can still transition and work great in the field.
Okay. And Heather, any thoughts on that same perspective from you?
Oh, I certainly agree with what Andrea just said. And I guess to that I'll add, you know, in discussions with the FRTR as we developed this bioremediation series, it became very clear that there's a need for better detection technologies. And certainly what Andrea is saying kind of touches to that, that unless we really know what's happening in the subsurface, it's, we may be making assumptions and we're just not sure. And so as these detection technologies get better, like in-well monitoring or other diagnostics, like what some of our omics researchers are doing, I think it will give more information about what's happening to understand the effectiveness. So,
okay.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. There are still a number of questions related to both Heather and Andrea's talks, but I'm going to hold them in the queue just in the interest of time. We do have additional time scheduled for later in the session, so Heather and Andrea, hopefully you can stay with us on the line because we may circle back to you again later today with some additional questions. At this point, Mark, I wanted to transition back to you to see if we can introduce our next speaker.
Very good. Our next two speakers will be presenting various case studies associated with inorganics and bioremediation. Our first speaker is Suhail El Abed. Suhail is a PhD research chemist at EPA's Office of Research and Development. His research encompasses remediation materials management and nanotechnology and includes novel methods to treat contaminated soils, sediments, and water. He has evaluated traditional water treatment options based on sorption, precipitation, and bioremediation at the bench, pilot, and field scales. Suhail has also developed a successful methodology to test metals removal with sulfate-reducing bioreactors, which will be the subject of today's talk. Dr. El Abed has authored or co-authored more than 100 peer-reviewed journal articles and 6 book chapters. He is also the chair of the Environmental Chemistry Division of American Chemical Services. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Suhail.
Okay, thank you, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to everyone about our work in EPA. As Mark mentioned, presentation today is going to be related to metal contamination or inorganics. The point that I want to make up front for the audience about metal contamination compared to organic contamination. And I think you know, Heather and Andrea touched on that just a little bit earlier. One important point about metals: you cannot degrade metals. You can change their species or different forms in the environment, but you cannot destroy them. You cannot mineralize them like you do with organic contaminants. So any bioremediation that will be used for metal contamination, it will be strictly to change the form from dissolved form or bioavailable or bioaccessible form into more stable, less or not bioavailable or bioaccessible. That's an important point because that will then go beyond just only the bioremediation or the remediation aspect of the work that anyone want to do on metal contaminated sites. In addition to that, is very critical that you think about how you can utilize biological activity to optimize this transformation of metals from one form to the other in order to reduce their risk to the environment. Okay, so in the presentation today, and I went back and forth on how much material I should present, and then I came down to be a little bit more general on my presentation today on sites that we actually deal with them in EPA. But there are a lot more extensive metal contamination that goes beyond the sites that we're dealing with. Just a note for everyone is that only west of the Mississippi, there is about 500,000 abandoned mining sites in the U.S., and 46,000 of them approximately that are in public land. Some of them are in private lands, and some are considered to be Superfund sites. The key issue is to utilize what's in the environment, and that's the bacteria that grows in this type of environment, and the type of metals, in addition to the toxic metals or the metals that we want to elevate their bioavailability and bioaccessibility, is using the iron oxidation and reduction in order for us to actually utilize bioremediation. And in this case, I'm going to talk about sulfate reduction. It's very critical is that you consider also where these bioremediation would take place. And locations, the elevation that they're in, they're all important factors that you should consider when you want to establish this bioremediation effort. Okay, so to do mine water treatments, there are, of course, options. And one of the words that I heard earlier in the talks is sustainability. So there are active systems that you could use, and that's usually use a lot of precipitation materials. So you could change the pH of mine influence water, and you could precipitate the metals into sludge. But then at the same time, you have to manage that. You need power. You need to remove the sludge between time to time and dispose of it. And you're going to make sure that sludge would not create future problems. Or you can use what we call passive systems, which uses no energy. It does not need necessary access throughout the year if the weather does not permit. And at the same time, it uses materials and it uses system. It uses biological system that it's actually exists at the same sites. So, based on that principle, is we adopting the sulfate reduction or sulfate reducing bioreactors and constructed wetlands, and I'll go through these in greater details. But again, the whole idea here is that how we utilize local site conditions using the biology and the chemistry and the geochemistry, of course, of the site in order to change the metals from bioavailable, bioaccessible to a form that it's has less risk to the environment. Okay, so what is a sulfate-reducing bioreactor? The cartoon that you see here, it shows different layers. That could be in a trench, and I don't get my arrow for some reason. Let's see here. All right. Okay. Okay, here we go. I got it now. Thank you. Okay, so in these bioreactors, you can put them in a trench, you can put them above the ground in tanks, you can construct them the way the design allowed to. A lot of it use natural gravity, so you don't have to use pumps, and you cannot you don't have to use energy and so on. So what you have is pretty much materials, and that's the brown material here, which is the substrate. That's usually the food for the bacteria. And choosing the substrate, and I'll go through it a little bit later in the talk, is going to depend on the site and the availability of it in the site, and that could be cost-effective and sustainable. And then you have some kind of transition zone between that reducing area there and the oxidative zone, which is at the top of this reactor. And then you have the water going through with the sulfate and using this substrate. In this case, the sulfate will be converted by the bacteria to sulfides, hydrogen sulfides, and bicarbonates. And then when there is a dissolved metal, and M, just a nomenclature for any metal, it will react with the hydrogen sulfide and it's going to form the sulfides. The sulfides are a very stable forms of almost any metal. So if you look at any solubility diagram of any metal, once it changes to sulfide, it become very difficult to be dissolved and be bioavailable. So this is pretty much the diagram that shows how we design these systems. Now, we also, part of this session talks about optimization. So to optimize that, you have design parameters for these sulfate reduction bioreactors. One of them, of course, is the pH, and you could have a pH that is optimum or the best pH, or you could actually deal with a range of pH possible based on the conditions that you have in the site. Oxidation reduction should be reducing conditions. And then hydraulic retention times, how much the waters actually have to stay there to be converted by the bacteria from one form to the other based on the equations that I showed you earlier. And that could be also a range in there. And then we talked about the substrates. The key about the substrates, and this is how I work with, for example, our Superfund remediation project managers in different regions, is the first thing I ask them is, what do you have available for you as substrate that it's actually on site? At the same time, what can you afford to buy something like, for example, crushed crab shells that you could buy either as a chitin, which is it could be sold, or you could use a combination of these two. And, of course, what type of buffering capacity material that you could use. All of these could be optimized when we look at the composition of the metals and how much we want to reduce them to a level that is acceptable for minimal risk to the environment and human health, of course. So you heard earlier from the speakers earlier about bench scale, about pilot scale. Well, we need to do that for a process like this. You really cannot just go and establish this bioreactors anywhere at any site without actually having some background about the type of water that you want to treat, what type of substrates that you have, and how you're going to optimize it and use it. And that's why we have to do the bench scales. And that's usually We do it in all our labs using the column studies. And then you move to the pilot scale, which is pretty much you take all the parameters that I showed earlier, two slides up, and try to upscale these parameters in a larger scale. And that means you want to see how that going to work when the size of the bioreactor get bigger and receives more volume of water. And then finally, you need to think about if these bioreactors still produce certain contamination or perhaps some of the other metals like the iron and the manganese, how do you go about doing a polishing step using these vertical constructed wetlands, which allow the water to go through different layers of different strata to actually either do an adsorption of some of these metals, or the iron, for example, or the manganese, or it could also be used by the plants as a phyto remediation, if you will, in these type of systems. So a combination of all of this will produce a successful treatment for the metal contamination in the specific water. So to show you this example here, this is actually from data that we used from a Superfund site that we have in Oregon. And you see the influent water here, and you see the metals. And I'm going to concentrate only on the zinc because it's the highest on this particular sample. There are samples that are higher in other type of metals. But you see that the zinc, for example, in the influent water, it was pretty high and much higher than the standard that is acceptable for surface water. And then once we use the chitins, which is this Cretaceous materials that I talked about earlier, we had a big reduction for the zinc. And when we treated with the pH adjustment, it also did reduce the amount of zinc that it's in the water. But when we use just ligneous column materials, which is like wood chips or hay, the reduction was less for the zinc compared to the chitin. Now, how did we do that? We do it in this column studies where we actually expose these water to these different treatments over time, and then we look at the removal rates of each metal. Okay. The next slide, these are pretty busy slides, but the messages are very clear here that for the pH, for example, again, whether we're using chitin or we're using different materials, the adjustment of the pH in these columns are different. And there is, an optimum best conditions to for the pH to to be suitable for the bacteria to act and change from changing the metals from one form to the other. The redox on the right side is also showing that these different these different substrates will produce these different redox potential. But again, we would like the redox potential always to be in the reductive state than the oxidation state. Okay, so these slides is actually showing the removal for the zinc and the sulfate. Now, why are we looking at the sulfate? Because the sulfate gets converted to sulfide, and then the zinc will precipitate as zinc sulfide, which is the most stable form. And again, here is showing that, for example, the chitin did have a much longer removal rate of the zinc than, for example, the ligneous that did break through much quicker than the chitin. And that gives us an idea that if we're going to design these systems and we're going to use these different substrates, we know when they're going to be exhausted and how we're going to then manage that material, whether we're going to replace it, whether we can regenerate it some way, somehow. But all of these parameters then will help us reaching that point. Okay, so we know that the sulfate is gone, and we know that the metal has precipitated. But we don't know if it is actually precipitated at sulfides. So what we do X-ray spectroscopy, and you have two graphs, one on the left side and one on the right side. Left side is XPS, and that's X-ray photoelectric spectroscopy. And that actually looks at the surface down to the about 20 angstrom. And you see here from these peaks that we are forming different species of sulfides on the surface. And that's an indication that we're actually forming the sulfides in our bioreactor. When we move to the right side, which we look at the zanes, and this is the near edge, X-ray spectroscopy, you see that there are this red and the blue lines here shows that these are actually zinc sulfide. So in addition to what we saw on the surface, which is sulfide, now we have a confirmation that is actually zinc sulfide, and that's in the treated columns. But in the untreated columns, which is the abiotic, we still have only zinc sulfate, which is, again, that's still bioavailable and bioaccessible. So that's a confirmation of how this works. Now we move to the pilot scale, and this is simply showing us that what we did in the column, we could actually upscale it here, and using for the flow, rather than using the pumps in the columns, we're actually using gravity, and we reach different hydraulic retention times. That number then for the hydraulic retention time and the hydraulic conductivity, it could be then expanded into the field conditions that actually will help us then expand on how we design this particular bioreactor with the water quality that is already on site, and what type of water quality we would like to achieve. So it's very important from the bench scale is to optimize these parameters in a pilot scale before you go to the field and you expand even further and design a much larger scale reactor based on the amount of volume of water that you want to treat. This is some of the data that we collected from this particular pilot scale. And the first graph, even it looks busy and up and down, but the whole idea here that the pilot scale did account for different fluctuation in the flow rates. And that means that if the flow rate changes, there is a possibility that we change the hydraulic conductivity. That means perhaps we're building a lot of biofilm. And that means that we have to control some of the flow that goes into the reactor and adjust it based on what will occur within the substrate and what type of hydraulic conductivity that we're measuring in the bioreactor or in the organic component of the bioreactor. And one of the things that we do is we take those materials and we take the same water and we run it through this different apparatus for the hydraulic conductivities, and we determine what's the optimum parameters or conductivity measurements that could be used to design the field scale of this reactors. The next graph shows again the fluctuations of the pH and the redox potential. And again, with the exception of some unexpected peaks, all of these parameters did follow the patterns that we had in mind for it, and that means that the information that we received from the column study and the pilot scale is giving us the ranges that needs for the field, and how we monitor those is going to become very important, that we do this in terms of keeping this optimization of the conversion of the metals from one form to the other using the most suitable conditions. The same thing with the sulfate and the zinc, the removal, as I showed you earlier in the column. Again, with some exceptions, and that happens in a larger scale, in the pilot scale, they both showed the same pattern. That means the sulfate is being converted to sulfide and precipitating the zinc as zinc sulfide. This table here is showing the why we do the bench, why we do the pilot. And as you see, there are different hydraulic retention time, different operational time, different sulfate removal rates. All of these will then enter into the optimization for the field conditions eventually when we apply this on a field scale. And this particular site, we are in the process of actually designing this field. It's going to be more than a demonstration. It's going to be actually a multi-year bioreactor for this particular site. There are some other bioreactors, but not necessarily designed the same way we did this, as we took it through all the steps from the bench to the field eventually. Okay, finally, this polishing steps that we talked about. We're thinking of the polishing step going to be with the using the biochar. In the earlier talk, someone mentioned the biochar. I believe it was Heather. That type of materials that we're planning to do for these vertical wetlands, it's again going to be designed based on the water chemistry. But the reason for using the biochar, we feel like it can not only capture the dissolved metals that may be escaping the bioreactor, but also the particulates. So the zinc sulfide, it would not be retained in the bioreactor. It could actually be retained here into the polishing step, which is the vertical wetlands. We're very excited about this. We know that it has worked in the lab very well, and we're excited about applying this eventually when we do the field demonstration using this component in addition to the bioreactor. I think that's it for the talk. These are the conclusions. simply the different substrates makes a difference. But at the same time, you have to be sustainable, and you have to take in consideration the cost and return on investment for using perhaps ligneous materials, but they will be broken through or exhausted quicker than a material that you have to buy, such as the chitin, for example. Or you can maybe make the chitin and you make it cheaper and you could use it. It's effective removing the metals, and I showed you only the zinc, but there are a lot of examples on other metals that they go through the same process. There are further research that needs to be done, but it's mostly optimization research and looking at different water chemistry from different sites. It's going to become a real important research aspect in the future. I think that's it for my talk. These are publications that it's going to be on the copy. If you are interested to look at that, there are other publications that it's related, but these are the most connected to the work. And thank you.
All right, thank you so much. We do have a number of questions in the queue, so I'm going to jump right in if it's all right with you. And the first question is asking about SRBs. So the participant noticed that for SRBs, the pH range of 5 to 8 appears wide. Is there an optimum pH, or is the optimum pH determined by site factors? And if so, what are those factors?
Okay, so this is a very good question. The most challenging things for bacteria is a very low pH, okay? So for sulfate reduction, this is the range that is optimum. But for example, the water that I showed you now, it starts at pH actually below 3. The way to bring that up, what you do is within the substrate, you could add some buffering to bring that for optimum bacterial activity. If the site has less acidity, you might not need that materials to actually reach the optimum sulfate reduction. So when you design these reactors using sulfate reduction, it's extremely important to look at the water quality information, pH, the type of metals that you want to remove, but also very important is metals that could compete with the toxic metals that it needs to be removed from the water, i.e. is iron. Stoichiometrically, if there is certain amount of sulfate in that water, then the iron and, for example, in the example I showed you, the zinc, they will both compete for that sulfate. So it's very important also to know the sulfate concentration. These particular reactors cannot be real successful for any sulfate concentration below 200 milligram per liter, for example. So pH is just one factor, but all the components of the water quality is critical for designing these bioreactor and make them successful. I hope I answered the question.
No, I think you did. That's excellent. Our next question is asking, can you treat arsenic, which is more mobile under reducing conditions?
Okay. Arsenic, mercury, and selenium are tricky. They are oxyions. Oxyions means they are they could become anions themselves. Okay? So, and there is arsenic 3, there is arsenic 5. The arsenic 3 is the one that is oxidized, and that's the one that actually we worry about more than the arsenic 5. The answer is yes, but it's very important that you tune your redox potential, and that's the EH that I was showing in the graphs. You have to tune that if you have arsenic in the water. You don't want to go too far in the oxidation states, because then you could actually mobilize the arsenic. Arsenic with the sulfate, it could easily form a very stable compound, which is that include iron and perhaps even aluminum, that it's in the water, in addition to the arsenic, makes a very stable compounds as sulfides. It's a combination. So with the arsenic and also the selenium to a certain extent, mercury is a whole different ballgame because of the methylation. But for arsenic, if you have the right conditions for the oxidation reduction potential and you have iron, you could be successful with this bioreactor.
All right, we'll move right into our next question. And this participant was wondering, is the bacteria a catalyst in the bioreaction or chemically part of the reaction? Or is it just impacting the kinetics of the reaction?
Okay, they are actually an active, they have an active role. Bacteria needs an electron donor within the system, okay? And the electron donor in this case is the sulfate, is the soluble sulfate. And the bacteria takes that, and once it takes that, and of course it needs the carbon source as food, and that's where the substrate is. But the once the electron removed, then the sulfate will convert to sulfides, and that's what created the precipitation of metal sulfides. So they are not only a catalyst, but they are actually active in the system, but in order for the system to work, you have to grow these first. The bacteria, and I, you know, just for the short time, I cannot really explain all the steps. For example, these columns that I showed earlier, you have to leave them for a while first, and the best indication, they turn black. You have to let the bacteria grow for a certain period of time before you start pumping the mine influence water in them. Why you want to do that? You want them to be active at that time when there is metals are coming through the influence, so is the sulfate and the other components. So it's real difficult to define them as catalyst or an active role. I would say they are doing both jobs at the same time, and that's why they are very resilient in the environment in the first place. We don't use any media from another site. We actually use the sulfate reduction bacteria that is actually from those sites themselves. They're already in the water anyway. We just grow them with these different substrates and let them thrive in order to do the conversions of the metals.
Okay, thank you. Our next question is asking, over the long term, for example, years and decades, how stable are the metal sulfide precipitants? They're wondering, under what conditions would you be concerned about resolubilization?
Excellent question. Okay, so that's part of the material management eventually for the residues that it's in the in the substrates where these metals are becoming sulfides. It depends on what sulfides you're making. Most sulfides are stable, but for example, galena or the lead sulfides. The lead sulfides could stay for a very long time at many different conditions without changing formation. Any one of us could practically ingest galena in our system, and then it goes through our system without any lead being absorbed through through the stomach acid. But other sulfide might be less stable. It's just based on the solubility diagrams for these different sulfides. But the way you manage that, and I think this is the best way to answer this question, the way you manage that is that you can keep these sulfides in certain conditions. And what I mean by certain conditions is based on their solubility. So if you expose them to oxidation conditions, for example, you expose them to much more aeration than is possibly they could withstand, then some of the metals could solubilize and comes out. But one of the things that we think about this is that we could reuse these materials, okay? I mentioned that in the vertical wetlands, and also the materials that there are the residues in these substrates. What we could use those, actually, we could use them as soil amendments. A lot of these sites have a lot of mine tailings where it was a mine processing waste practically that is left on sites. And to revegetate those, we could use this organic material with having this very stable metal compounds. And we could use them as a soil amendment or soil building component where we can actually grow plants on them. And the plants then, it could even stabilize more of these materials. So this could be a very well sustainable, comprehensive way of remediating sites using different type of bioremediation. From the bioreactor to the constructed wetlands to also soil amendments using the substrates to revegetate some many of these sites.
Excellent. I believe we'll just take one more question and then we'll move on to our next speaker. And so this last question is looking for additional studies. So this participant is specifically asking, are there any bioremedial studies on the reduction of hexavalent chromium to trivalent chromium?
Yes, but I'm not too familiar with those. The problem with chromium, again, is the same as the arsenic. Again, they are oxyions, and you got to be very careful how you design these bioreactors. I personally have not worked on that, but it should work by understanding the water chemistry again of the media that you're trying to remediate.
Gene, I can add to that a little bit, Gene. I mean, I do know there's a Superfund site that our Kansas City district worked on for EPA where they did in situ anaerobic transition of chromium 6 to trivalent chromium, just doing kind of normal anaerobic carbon substrate amendment injections, which using horizontal wells and whatever to do it in situ. So again, it's all based on maintaining that reduction state. But usually once you get the metals to precipitate out, it takes a lot to get them to precipitate back in again, or to dissolve back into groundwater again.
Yes, but it's very critical about the maintaining that particular oxidation state. I'm not familiar with that site, yes, there is a good potential to work on chromate type contamination or contaminated water to do that type of biological precipitation. Now, I'm not really sure if they use sulfate reduction or not. Do you know, Mark?
As far as I know, it's just normal carbon substrate addition, where they just converted it to an anaerobic reducing condition.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there are
sulfates in the, yeah, could have had sulfates in the groundwater environment, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's for sulfate reduction, you need the sulfate, to do that type of conversion. So, the bioreactor, there are some other bioreactors, of course, that does not use necessary sulfate, but it's for metals is they are very rarely used because you cannot really convert them to sulfides where you can change their solubility.
All right. I think perhaps in the interest of time, Mark, it's time to move on to our last speaker in our series today. Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay.
Our last speaker will be presenting another case study site. It's Haruko Murakami. Haruko is a research scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Her research focus has been on hydrogeological modeling, spatial statistics, data integration, and uncertainty quantification. She has worked on various research topics in both nuclear waste, groundwater contamination, and climate change impacts on ecosystems. She earned a master's in nuclear engineering and statistics and a PhD in nuclear engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. And I'll turn it over to you, Haruko.
Hi, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay? Hello? Yes? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
You're good.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for having me here. I would like to acknowledge Ken Williams, my co-author. He has been working on bioremediation of uranium and other inorganic contaminants for more than 20 years, and we co-developed these slides. And I'll talk about long-term monitoring and also bioremediation for organic contaminants, particularly uranium. So As a researcher at DOE Department of Energy Labs, we have been working on mainly on the remediation of nuclear weapon sites. There are more than 106 sites that were used for nuclear weapon production under the Department of Energy. Most of these sites have significant contamination. The two famous ones are Hanford site. Hanford site, and Savannah River site. But there are many other sites, in particular, in Colorado or Arizona. Of these states, have many uranium mining and mill tailing sites. Across the sites, the key elements have been identified. Surprisingly or unsurprisingly, we tend to see similar nuclei across the different sites, even though the climate is very different from arid west to very hot and humid east. Uranium come as a priority at many sites, including Hanford site, these uranium mill tailing sites, and Savannah River site. And most of the elements are heavy metals, including mercury and chromium. These are the priority elements that are potentially threat for public health. And these priority elements are known to be mobile in the element compared to the other radionuclides like plutonium or other radionuclides which are immobile. And soil groundwater research recently have been focused on these elements. Large plumes at DOE sites are often associated with low-level radioactive liquid waste disposal, including uranium oil processing, fuel fabrication, and reprocessing at Savannah River site, for example. In 1950s or even in 80s, the sites were disposing low-level radioactive waste solution in these ponds or in the grounds, and we have low-level but big radioactive groundwater plumes. I would like to introduce one of the sites, DOE rifle sites, which used to be the uranium processing facility. It is in Colorado between Grand Junction and Denver. The facility closed in the 50s, went through a cleanup, and currently the site is under monitored natural attenuation. So this is how the site looked like. There used to be a big tailing pond here. The site is basically a floodplain right next to the Colorado River, and it used to have a Union Carbide Corporation. The facilities closed in late 50s or early 60s. The tailings were consolidated and stabilized and moved to other locations. And they started other site called New Life Site. The site was closed and the topsoil was removed, and they put so-called filling material, low permeability material at the near the surface to limit the infiltration. And there is a groundwater plume, uranium plume, under this site. I would say rifle site has been the prime site for uranium bioremediation. I think the most extensively studied sites for radium bioremediation. If you Google radium and bioremediation, probably you'll find RIFL for sure. There have been so many papers ranging from field experiments, geophysical monitoring techniques, and also modeling studies to evaluate radium bioremediation. This site also has the best data sets of knowledge in terms of subsurface microbiology and biochemistry. There have been so many groundbreaking studies, like Nature Science papers, focused on subsurface microbial communities and their functions. So this is the typical setup for bioremediation experiments. Typically, we install many wells of injections and also monitoring wells to evaluate the effect. Most of the studies we call biostimulation. It's actually the same as the previous talk. So Hale gave really nice overview of the approach. So we don't introduce new microbes, but we stimulate native microbes who already live there by injecting, in this case, for example, acetate, which is basically food for these organisms. So they grow with more food, or we have injected, for example, oxygen or nitrate, which stimulate their growth and their activities. Basically, microbes eat carbon acetate and they grow, and in this process they metabolize food and they change the redox conditions as Sohail introduced. And in this case, they change the oxidation state of rhenium from 6, which is mobile, to rhenium 4, which is immobile and precipitates. This is not just for rhenium. They can change the oxidation state of other metals, for example, iron from iron 3 to iron 2, ferric iron to ferrous iron, so the soil color turns from red to black, and we can see more rhenium precipitation or solid phase rhenium in black soil. So this is the typical result of the bioremediation experiments. So this is a rhenium. Having trouble grabbing this arrow. So this is a rhenium concentration as a function of time, days. So this is the experiment over almost. More than 3 years experiments. So blue part is the acetate amendment injection part. So during the injection, acetate injection, microbial activities increase and rhenium concentration decrease. And the post-injection period, the rhenium concentration actually rebound, we always see. This is another acetate injection, rhenium concentration decrease, and eventually increase a little bit. It's great to see the repeatability of rhenium removal. Well, in this case, rhenium is removed from the aqueous phase. It stays in the site. It stays in the solid site, solid phase. But rhenium is stuck in this case in the soil and doesn't move and does not pose any risk. Doesn't migrate to the downgradient groundwater or river. But we can see that we always have rebound after some time. So the conclusion is that this technology is great to immobilize rhenium, but we have to keep adding acetate all the time. So after a series of bioremediation studies, we actually looked at more sort of natural environments. We found so-called naturally reduced zones. The floodplain have a lot of organic carbons, which used to be like twigs or roots or anything comes out from the river. And we can see it's very black. This is the sediment actually from the well, like 4 meters below the surface, visibly reduced sediment, and we actually see very high concentration of uranium and other metals. So we see that this is sort of the natural bioremediation occurring, and we want to, and it is a very sustainable way. So we wanted to study this naturally occurring reduced zone. And first, we need to understand how they are distributed across the floodplain. We used geophysical method. It's called induced polarization method to map this naturally reduced zone. So we laid electrodes across the floodplain, and we basically visualized the 3D subsurface of this floodplain. This technique provides basically two quantities. One is electrical resistivity of soil and phase shift, which is related to electrical double layers at the solid aqueous interfaces and also related to mineral characteristics. And we have found that this naturally reduced zone provides pretty distinct characteristics in these two signals, and we can actually map naturally reduced zone in the floodplain along with this aqueous layer, different layers. So we have, I would say that this is one of the best characterized sites in terms of subsurface heterogeneity. We also see that surface infiltration is one of the potential vulnerability to change the system, particularly like redox state is sensitive to oxygen coming from the surface and atmosphere. And we have used, for example, UAB to map the very fine micro scale topography, micro scale surface subsidence, and we can identify where is infiltration is happening, where is the significant breach of the barrier. And we also used time-lapse electrical resistivity tomography to estimate hydraulic parameters like permeability and also estimate infiltration happening through the cap rock. We also are thinking about fiber optics technology for spatial temporal monitoring, but that's a great technology to monitor the subsurface. And we are still looking for better bioremediation technologies. And recently, Ken has started appetite-based technologies, and which has been very successful and promising. So I'd like to share this new development. Appetite has been used probably since 90s or early 2000s as a barrier, permeable reactive barrier. So we can dig the trench and put appetite, and that can filter many metals and clean up the groundwater, the downgradient groundwater. Recent focus has been, we call sort of injectable barrier. So instead of digging trench, we can inject solutions so that it's much less costly compared to digging trench, and we can introduce a solvable treatment material or treatment solutions. So in this case, we are still using microbes, but instead of microbe changing redox state, microbes create the redox state to facilitate co-precipitate of appetite. And appetite can trap a lot of metals inside. So more detail about appetite, hydroxide, in this case, particularly hydroxyapatite. So hydroxyapatite is a three-dimensional lattice of calcium phosphate mineral. And basically, instead of this calcium, this calcium part can be replaced by rhenium or other metals. And these metals get trapped inside of this mineral. This hydroxyapatite is very stable and extremely low stable, so it can assure that immobilization for extended time. It can sequester a wide variety of radionuclides, heavy metals, and other contaminants through the structure of sorption into this lattice. The great thing about this technology is that it is immobilizing rhenium as oxide form, so not that rhenium-4, this is rhenium-6, so it is less prone to reoxidation or changes in redox conditions. And we can inject the solutions through the well, so we don't have to dig the trench. So I'd like to share some of the experiments and experiment results. So this is, again, experimental design, very similar to previous experiments with previous experiments with acetate and biostimulation. We have an injection well and many monitoring wells, and also we have a control well in upgradient, which is not affected by the bioremediation. So this is the result for rhenium. Interesting. The color didn't come up. So this well is the control well, blue control well. So the this is the rhenium concentration as a function of time, more than 2 years. So the rhenium concentration at the control well is constant. And this is the injection well. The rhenium concentration goes down and stayed low for more than 2 years without any re-injection of treatment. Ken said that he had never seen such a dramatic effect. Compared to other bioremediation treatments, this is truly remarkable to sustain immobilization for such a long time. Well, there is some rebound. I'll talk about it later. But the rebound happens only, let's say, three wells within this monitoring wells. So this immobilization effect was not just for rhenium. This is a vanadium. Again, compared to control well, which is flat concentration, many monitoring wells showed lowered concentration for extended time, and even arsenic concentration decreased significantly over time. Here is a close-up of the rhenium concentration. This is the control well, injection well, and one of the monitoring well. So before the treatment or in the control well, the concentration of rhenium was above the Umatraca limit. After the treatment, the concentration reduced dramatically and stays below the limit for more than 2 years, which is remarkable. But there's a bump, and this bump turned out that it's not remobilization, but this bump was basically from the new source. So after almost like 10 years or I think like 30 years of this doing research at rifle site, we found out that there is a lot of residual rhenium contaminants in the upgradient of this experiment window. And when the groundwater is very high, the residual contaminants actually can get released, and rhenium concentration can come down to this experimental window. So that's why not all the wells show rebound, only one or two wells. And this is this CD14 was direct downgradient of the residual contaminants. And this year had, I think 2017 had particularly large snow year, so the groundwater table was high and taking a lot of residual contaminants to the groundwater. So based on these results, we are actually trying to establish better groundwater monitoring, like groundwater table monitoring based on low-cost in-situ sensors, wireless network, cloud computing. So this is actually not just the rifle site, but we are developing this new paradigm of monitoring across all the DOE sites. Now, currently, there are so many sensors that are available to measure groundwater quality parameters, like water table, pH, redox, and electrical conductivity. So we can measure, let's say, groundwater flow direction, groundwater table, which is very relevant for bioremediation, as you saw in the previous slide. At the same time, we can consider that these indices or these parameters are actually pretty related to contaminant concentrations, as you saw in the previous talk, like pH, redox are the key controls. So we can actually estimate contaminant concentration based on these in situ sensors, and instead of taking groundwater samples every year or every quarters, this technology can enable us to monitor groundwater real time, and we can consider that early warning system. I would skip this part actually. Yes, I think that we think that these technologies are very important to move forward in the future. For example, we just published a paper about climate change impact, or the impact of very large rain events on groundwater contamination and residual contaminants. We found that the large rain event, for example, have very complex response. For example, if there's a big rain, first we see dilution, and then we see a rebound of concentration because a lot of contaminants get remobilized from the residual source. So in order to prepare for such effect, we have to have better monitoring technologies. Yes, sorry, I need to finish up the talk, sorry. We are developing the data analytics workflow, for example, and based on the machine learning, we can identify different parameters, for example, specific conductance that we can measure based on the sensors, in situ sensors. We found it's very correlated with rhenium concentrations, and we developed machine learning method to estimate rhenium concentrations based on the in situ measure parameters. So I will try to skip a little bit, sorry. We published this in situ monitoring technologies, and we got a lot of interest, and I think people are interested in machine learning application in environment. I think it was mentioned in earlier talk as well. So now we are actually extending this approach, and under Office of Environment Management, we have a big project called Advanced Long-Term Monitoring System Project. We are trying to couple these three elements, like new sensing technologies in addition to in-situ sensors and UAV that you saw in this presentation. We are investing more in the new geophysics and fiber optics technologies. We are developing the high-performance computing-based modeling technologies that can inform machine learning or new data acquisition as well. Okay, so sorry to be late. This is the summary of this presentation. In general, bioremediation of rhenium or heavy metal is done by controlling redox conditions to reduce solubility of metal. We found biostimulation is promising, and also we observed sort of naturally effective, naturally reduced zone, which is actually effective to accumulate heavy metal. And we, as a new technology, we found that permeable reactive barrier, acetate, apatite-based technology is very promising. We found that monitoring is very critical to quantify the effect of bioremediation, particularly to understand the variability of groundwater flow direction, groundwater table, and associated effect on bioremediation. And as I said, the heavy metal is precipitated, but it's not gone from the site, so it requires long-term monitoring. And we think that new technologies like AI sensing and modeling capabilities have a great potential to assure the stability of immobilized contaminants and also reduce the risk at these sites. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. A number of participants have already entered questions into the Q&A window for you, so I'll jump into those in a moment, but I will let the audience know we'll also open a broader Q&A period at this time. So if you have questions for other speakers and you didn't yet enter them in, you're certainly welcome to do so using that Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. Harugo, I'm going to start with this first question, and one of our participants has asked, how long does citrate last in the subsurface aquifer?
So the effect seems to last, theoretically, once apatite is formed, it's very stable and it's supposed to stay immobile for extended time. In our experiments, it's been 2-3 years and we didn't see rebound of concentration except for the new mobilized contaminants from the residual source.
Okay. Is the apatite crystal structure necessary to trap, or only the calcium phosphate as a chemical agent is needed, or is it a combination of them both?
I would defer that question to my, sorry, yeah, I work mostly on the monitoring side, so the chemical side, I have to defer to Ken. His email address is here, so it would be great you can send those questions to him, sorry.
Okay.
Or I can get back to you. If someone gives me the email address on the chat window, I can get back to you later.
Okay, thank you. Our next question is asking, is the injection of the hydroxyapatite done as a slug, or is it continuous?
It was continuous and just once.
Okay, is the volume and concentration based on reaction with a mass of uranium in place?
You mean that the volume was calculated based on the amount of rhenium, or?
I believe so. So, their exact wordage was, is the volume and concentration based on reaction with mass of uranium in place?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the amount of uranium and amount of uranium concentrations were evaluated before the injection.
Okay. And how long do you propose to monitor immobilization?
Yes. In the regulatory context, right? Or in
right.
the, I think, so this technology is very new. So I think it has not been sort of got to the regulatory or even site operation context yet. Traditionally, monitored natural attenuation, we did not define any sort of the end date, but if this technology is successful to actually immobilize, I think it depends on how long, well, this experiment has been running for 3 years now, and we did not see the rebound, so I think this is more, it depends on the negotiation between the site and the regulatory agencies. But this this technology could potentially provide sort of the evidence to stop monitoring, because theoretically the trapped contaminants don't move. But I think, yeah, it's very early stage, so I don't think we can say that yet.
Okay. Can the hydroxyapatite injection alter the local permeability enough to alter flow pathways towards your monitoring wells?
That's a great question. So far, we don't think so, but that would be a great topic to investigate.
Okay. Have you had the chance to do any spectroscopy to prove the formation of stable U compounds?
Again, sorry, I have to check with my co-author, Ken Williams. I assume so, but yeah, this is basically, they have not published any paper yet. So the paper will come soon, and if you have questions at this point, I think it's best to email Ken Williams.
Okay. I'll ask the audience again, if you have additional questions, please feel free to enter them into the Q&A window now in the lower right. But if you have no questions, that's also equally valuable information. We want to be sure to allow additional time here to answer questions and have the audience interact. But if there are no other questions, you can enter that into the queue and let me know. I do have a handful more that are in the queue, so I will come back to those. But I wanted the audience to know that if you feel as though you've gotten all of your questions answered and you don't have anything else to enter in, please feel free to send that message into the Q&A window in the lower right corner. So going back to you, Haruko, another question. Can you add dissolved oxygen to the monitored indicators?
In terms of the in-situ sensors, yes, there are in-situ oxygen sensors available. So I think that would be a great sensor to add.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go back to another question, and this one actually was for Heather Henry. So, Heather, if you're still on the phone, if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to ask you to come off of mute.
Sure.
And this participant wanted to know, are there any bioremedial techniques for metals that you're aware of which are being employed at Superfund sites for either remedial actions or removals? They're specifically asking, if you're aware of these types of projects, how does the cost and time of the bioremediation work compared to geochemical work?
Well, I think that would be a good question for Sue Hale, and I wonder if that question might have come in before Sue Hale's presentation, because he did speak about quite a few instances where metals are being, or bioremediation is being used for metals. And is Sue Hale still on?
He is. Do you want to take a stab at that one?
Yeah. So The answer is yes, but it's in different stages, okay? You cannot just have a blanket answer and say, we applied the bioremediation in so many Superfund sites, and these are the results. Instead, they are at different stages, at different applications, but compare that to the active treatment. You know, I talked about passive and active treatment. There are more, and I think the person with the question is saying geochemical, I believe. Perhaps he means a chemical precipitation or chemical reagent type remediation. That is more common than the bioremediation. Now, also Heather mentioned something about phytoremediation. Phytoremediation was also applied in some Superfund sites. The problem was, what would you do with the plants once you accumulate the metals in these plants? And especially if they have leaves that they could fall and, you know, the part of the plant could actually be transported from one place to the other, you know, having these metals in their tissues. All of these were, you know, all these trials or all this work has been applied in certain Superfund sites, but I would not say that there is any of these technologies or bioremediation type. It's a dominant one. The bioreactors is what we're working on. It's probably gaining the most momentum right now because it actually based on transforming the metals from one form to the other and by doing that, reducing the risk to human health and ecosystem. I hope I answered the question.
I think you did a great job. Thank you. So, Hill, while we were there on the line, we did have a question about the sulfate reduction. Some participants were concerned if when you reduced the sulfide, or when you, pardon me, reduced from sulfate to sulfide, they wondered if anything would remain in the system as free sulfide and cause an odor problem.
Okay. very good question here. So first of all, these are very remote areas. And probably odor and smell, it really not going to be that big of an issue. But one thing is, in the cartoons that I was showing, and I see my slides back again. Maybe I can go back to see here. This one here. If you see here is the top here, that could actually be covered, and that will contain a lot of the odor and the smell from the hydrogen sulfide, which it smells like a rotten egg practically. But at the same time, the hydrogen sulfide that is formed, it's temporary, if you will. As the process takes place, it changes then to metal sulfides and reducing the hydrogen sulfide that's in there. Third point I would make about this is temperature. A lot of these sites are in higher elevation, temperature drops. Once that happens, it's some of the biological activity, even if it stays dormant, it also reduces the emission of some of these gases because they would not expand with the temperature and then being released. So there is a lot of ways to contain them, but I would say also they are really site-specific because there are sites, even if you don't contain it, it's not going to affect anybody practically.
Okay.
One thing I'm going to add about this, in the pilot scale, we actually, since we are doing this in our high bay area, we did measure the hydrogen sulfide for another reason, not the smell, but it is, you know, concentration. You have to worry about health effects, you know, especially if you are doing it within, you know, confined space. And the concentration was not that high to actually introduce any safety issues, at least at the pilot scale size in the enclosed areas. Okay, thanks.
Okay. All right. Another question for you. Have you determined the degree that the bioavailable zinc is removed by sulfate reduction compared to something like wetland plant uptake?
You mean as a comparison?
Yes.
Is that what you, well, we did, I mean, I've been working on this for about 20 years now, and plant uptakes, it cannot be as efficient as this process. The only thing is that plants could help in here is in these vertical wetlands, which is, again, it's a polishing, conditions. One thing for the person who is asking the question is the media, the water that we deal with, there is no way you can grow plants on. I mean, this particular site that I showed you, and that's an example of many sites, again, the pH is about 2, between 3 and 2, and the metal concentration is very high. Really, plant uptake for conditions like this is almost impossible, unless I have not seen any work that could or any research that could actually grow plants in conditions like this that could uptake the so there is no way really to compare, if you will.
Okay. Another question for you, Sohail. Given that a stoichiometric excess of phosphorus is likely required, what concerns are there for unreacted phosphorus to enter surface water and then create eutrophication, and that's assuming that the waters are phosphorus limited?
Where does the phosphorus come from?
They're assuming that a stoichiometric excess of phosphorus is likely required.
I'm not really sure why. Are you sure this is not for Haruko, the question?
It's possible. I'm sorry. This one kind of came in a funny order. So
She's using hydroxyapatite, and that's a phosphorus.
Okay. Haruko, do you want to try to answer this one? And Haruko, you may be still muted on the line. So, Haruka, I know you're on the phone.
I detailed the chemistry part. I'm not that expert, and I'm afraid giving you a wrong answer. So,
okay.
The zero chemistry part, it would be great if you can, please email Ken Williams, please. Sorry.
Okay. I
could help in that.
Okay.
Even. It's not the, but yeah, hydroxyapatite provide the phosphorus for the precipitation. Okay, and I think this is what Hiroko is presenting by complexing the uranium then with the hydroxyapatite. So stoichiometrically, it will compete, just like what I talked about iron and the zinc in my work, competing over the sulfate to form the sulfides. This is going to be the same. You have to make sure that there is enough phosphorus that other, let's say you have lead, lead tends to complex with a hydroxyapatite very easily and could scavenge a lot of the phosphorus too. So that is an important parameter that needs to be looked at when you optimize this system. And I'm sure Hiroko's team has looked at that.
All right. Thank you so much. I think just in the interest of time, we'll probably go ahead and close out this Q&A period, but I will remind the audience that each of the presenters has shared their contact information in their presentation slides. So for those of you that may have asked more detailed or technical questions, or perhaps we had one brought up and the presenters have asked that you reach out later, remember, you'll find their contact information right in the presentation content, and you're certainly welcome to reach out to them directly. There are a few final reminders that I will walk the audience through, but before I jump into that, I just wanted to check with Mark Rothis to see if there are any final thoughts that he'd like to leave the audience with before I give out those closing reminders for today's session.
I'm good, Gene. Outside to remind everybody that both of these sessions from last week and this week will be archived on the Acluin Archives part of their website for others that might be interested, if you want to forward the information to them.
All right, excellent. I will do. So I want to thank you, Mark, for sharing those reminders, and let's walk through just a few quick final other items before we close out today's live broadcast. So as was indicated, this is session number 2 in a 2-part series. So both of the FRTR Spring 2020 meetings will be archived on the CLUIN website. You will receive an email as soon as today's archive is available for on-demand playback. But these two meetings are not the only FRTR sessions that have been archived on CLUIN. There's a wide variety of presentation series that have been hosted over the years that you'll be able to find if you visit the CLUIN archive page. So if you're interested in these topics or want to learn more about the sessions that have been sponsored by FRTR, I strongly encourage that you visit the archive website and you can search for FRTR sponsored sessions. You'll also be able to learn more about cleaning up and characterizing hazardous waste sites at our CLUIN or Cleanup Information Network. I encourage you to visit us there. And please be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. I send it out on the first of each month. So if you are not a subscriber but would like to learn more about sessions like today, I strongly encourage that you register for that free newsletter so that you can stay up to date as soon as sessions have been prepared. As noted, today's sessions are available for download. You'll find that on the seminar resources page that is already hyperlinked on the middle right of your screen. Simply scroll to the list of interest, or pardon me, the link of interest, press its name to select it, and then click the Browse To button to open it up. If you are watching the recorded version of today's session, please know that that archived link will also work. So based off of your replay, you can still click those links and open it up. I've also included it in the Q&A window in the lower right if that's easier for some people. Contact information, as I noted, can be found for our presenters on the seminar homepage. That homepage is where you checked in today, and it will be available from today forward. And then, of course, I will ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Now, what I get asked the most frequently for our sessions is if we offer professional training hours like CEUs or PDHs, and while we don't issue those particular credit hours, we can provide you with a participation certificate after you fill out that online feedback form. So please follow the link to the feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both the content that we covered and the mechanics that we used to host it. There are two important steps, though, when you're filling out that form. Please be sure to enter your email address correctly and make sure that you check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to then, when submitting, generate a certificate. If you don't check that box or you don't fill out the feedback form, you will not receive a certificate. So if you are interested in getting a certificate to document your attendance and then combine that with the materials and your registration email, that's usually enough to verify your attendance and get credit with your own accrediting institution. So remember, you must fill out the feedback form, you must enter your information in correctly, and you need to check that box certifying you were here for the whole thing. Then as soon as you submit feedback, you can download or print out a certificate. If you are watching the recorded version, those links will still work, so you can actually fill out feedback based off of your replay of the archive. And with that, I want to thank the over 250 individuals who joined us live for today's session. We really valued your input and your participation in our session today. We hope that this has been a valuable expenditure of your time. And I also want to thank all of our organizers and presenters who shared their technical expertise. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast and hope that you'll be joining us soon on a future Clue In seminar.